I'm Susan Montanaro, and you're listening to Dreams and Detours, a show about the life we plan to have versus the one we're living, for better or not. Everybody has a story, and I believe we find ourselves in each other's stories. Hi, it's Susan Montanaro. I had the great fortune to sit down with Michelle Reines, a speaker, author, coach, entrepreneur, ever-evolving badass leader, and founder of MDR Coaching and Consulting. In full disclosure, this episode contains discussion of sexual abuse and survival. While we were digging around in the early days of Michelle's professional life about unconscious leadership, she shared her motivation to pursue a high-profile sales career and pulled the veil back on her upbringing to reveal where her resilience and survival skills were born. Her childhood was disrupted by a sexually abusive stepfather who then adopted Michelle when she was just a young girl. Her adoptive father would end up having custody of her until she left home at 17 years old. Michelle's ambitious mindset and determination drove her to not just survive, but to find success in a big way. She would learn quickly that survival skills only get you so far, that nurturing herself and developing true leadership skills is the pathway forward. Michelle is an incredible force, bringing business-building leadership to CEOs and leaders worldwide. While her adoptive father is now deceased, her current stepfather has been an incredible role model and loving parent, bringing her healing journey full circle. Michelle's book, Badass Leader, is a must-read and critical tool for anyone building successful teams and companies. And as you will hear, I'm so impressed with and delighted to talk about the great work she is doing. Please welcome Michelle Reines. Hi, Michelle. It's so good to see you today.
Great to see you too. It's always fun to connect.
Yeah, no, it's been great seeing you online in our different shared spaces. I think that the more I get to be with you, you know, in whether it's on LinkedIn or in Clubhouse or wherever we're actually seeing one another, I admire and enjoy all of the content and you, really. I think that's what it sums up to. And it's like this connection has been so brilliant. So I'm so happy that we're recording today and we get to do a podcast together. So thank you.
Me too. And I echo those sentiments exactly. It's just fantastic. I think we fit very comfortably and our philosophies blend well and complement one another as far as our belief and just the journey.
Right. And that's what this has been. This has been a wild time. And I say that because truthfully, I feel like we have to continue to acknowledge the roughness of the last few months. I mean, you know, everyone is bouncing back or coming back in some form or shape. And I feel like a lot of what you and I do will complement and really help people as they pivot, because that's still actually occurring.
As
they redeploy their mission and the strategies around it and what it might look like now. Because even though we could look out and say, oh, you know, so many businesses look like they're back to normal and people just keep using that like back to normal expression. I think for a lot of people, that's normal is like still a little bit of a distance off, whatever that means for them. So.
Yeah, and I even think that normal's been completely redefined. I mean, it's definitely, we've heard the term new normal, but I even think about, the evolution of my business. It is so incredibly contrasted to what it was 18 months ago. And I, you know, at the beginning of this, you know, crazy pandemic, I, you know, immediately kind of pulled up my sleeves and said, okay, so I didn't know if I was going to be out of work for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 4 months, right? So I thought I treated it as if I only had 2 weeks. And so what can I do really quickly where I get to work in my business instead of just, on my business instead of just in my business. And so that I can have something to offer of greater value at the end of 2 weeks. And then it just kept, you know, getting pushed out further and further. And I kept kind of shoving having those sleeves up further and digging back in. And I haven't stopped, even though I am back in front of customers and doing more face-to-face. I'm continuing to evolve and reinvent, or I should say add on and bolt on different value in my business. And I think that that's kind of the new norm, is how can we not become complacent and avoid that risk of mediocrity. I think it's good for us. It's kind of like shedding of skin and renewal of opportunity. And I think it's refreshing and invigorating, both intellectually as well as it is, you know, stressful.
Absolutely.
But it's really what we make of it, right? Do with that stress, make it a positive stress instead of a negative.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the thing. Not only is it really smart to have many options now to offer, but for so many, we're going to need that, because there are people who are not going to necessarily either want to return to what we had been offering or the way in which we were doing business previously. People have moved. People have redefined what work means to them and where they do it. Not everyone will have the same schedule carved out that they did prior, or the same priorities that they had prior. So yes, you know, everyone is doing what you just said, you know, refreshing and reinvigorating their lives and really redeploying what life is to them and what the work life looks like to them. Like, everything has changed. So yeah. I think it's smart that you latched on to all that would be possible in whatever vein it needed to be.
Well, and I think that it's vital and essential that we remain nimble and not fall back into that sameness. You know, I think that there's something really good for everyone out of this possibility. And I anticipated, I did a video, I think it was in March of last year, where I just hopped on and did a little selfie video and posted it on my website. And I think I called it Anticipation. And I was anticipating that the initial blow of the at home, you know, having to work remotely would be kind of that negative where I can't be efficient. I can't get stuff done. I'm so frustrated. I can't walk down the hall and talk with John and, you know, so on and so forth. But I also said that if we're in this long enough, I think the opposite will be true, where now we become more efficient, more effective. We really start to reconnect with our neighborhoods, our communities, the outdoors, our families, our friends very differently. We reprioritize our life. And so now it's like the remote worker is willing to do more to stay home and take sacrifices, even pay cuts, and in order to have that freedom and flexibility. And I embrace the idea of kind of being what I would say an entrepreneur within a corporate structure, where you have that freelance potential or capability and flexibility, but you'll perform at a higher output. You'll be more engaged at, you know, what we call the self-actualization level, where you're really running it like you own it. And at the highest level, and then your qualitative aspects of your life are so enriched. So I think it's an exciting possibility for what different organizations are faced with, some decisions that they get to make. Yeah. And they're going to attract some really amazing talent if they can, you know, remain in embracing and figuring this remote work thing out. How do we create cohesive cultures and high performance teams within a remote and freelance environment under the umbrella of a corporate structure? So I'm intrigued.
Sort of ties right into everything that you stand for and everything that you look to be in your own leadership role, as well as the way in which you coach leaders. I think it's brilliant, actually, how the setup exists today because of COVID. I mean,
yeah,
there are so many silver linings here, but especially to the work that you do and to the work that many coaches do. But really, I'm thinking specifically you, because you are the badass leader. We know it. But a lot of your philosophy really points to trusting our employees. I mean, trust is a huge factor.
Huge.
You write about it in your book. You talk about it and you lead with it. You know, if you can't trust your teams to be the talent that you hired them to be and to do the work and to aim toward the goal for the better of everyone, then what are we doing here? You know, that's right. An essential ingredient in good leadership, in positive leadership, and in successful leadership. And so I think the work from home dynamic that people are experiencing today, and those who don't want to give it up, because I know plenty of people who are anxious to return to an office. They really prefer structure. They like being live and in person. And I think that's beautiful. Believe me, I'm very much an in-person kind of person myself. However, I like the fact that we now have an option, or yes, many people have the option, and therefore we need to look out and say, how do we treat and still continue to nurture these employees and these individuals? And the first thing that comes to my mind is trust. We need to trust that they're able to do what they need to do. And you're right. I feel like when you give people the space to combine life and be whole, and not have to divvy themselves up, and this is my work version, and this is my home version, and I'm mom, or I'm sister over here, or I'm just good to myself over there, you know, because I'm an individual, like single or whatever, but they get to be their full version of themselves. And therefore, productivity goes up. Work hours can be whenever they need to be, but the work gets done.
Yeah. And the metrics change, right? So we measure outcomes, and we're just, you know, open to a different possibility. And I love the idea of allowing people to make that choice. I think their vesting is much richer when they get to choose whether they're more productive and really want to be in a corporate structure and have that setting of going into the office. Maybe they go into the office 2 or 3 days a week, but the freedom to choose and be measured based on output, impact, contribution to team and culture, impact to customer experiences. You know, the metrics are broader and they're different. And I think it really is inspiring for a lot of people to have that flexibility, and they will do extra mile behavior in order to have a vote. You know, I think that's important. So exciting.
So we're starting off, and I love that we started off our conversation just really talking about this, because again, I feel like we cannot really ignore where we're at as a society. But I want to turn it a little bit, because the whole point is, you've written this beautiful, amazing book about leadership lessons, 12 of them to be specific. But this really comes out of, because we're going to pedal back now, this really comes out of and stems from your own growth from leadership at a very early stage in your professional life. This comes from your own journey of discovering, kind of falling on your face a little bit, but discovering who you are, what it means to be a leader, and having, like I said, the opportunity to learn that a little earlier on than some people might get. I mean, not everyone in their 20s gets to become at the top of the food chain within their organization, or at least near the top, and have that really important leadership role. And so I feel like a lot of this stems from this amazing journey of trial and error, and you discovering who you are essentially over the course of time. But before we talk about how it all started and why these tenets of like leadership are so important to you, what even drove you? Because you went into a really high powered career early on. You're in sales. I spent many years myself, like the first, like, you know, 20 plus years of my career in sales. So I feel like we really connect on that level, because there's something different about the headspace of a person who works in sales and has that very high achieving sensibility to them, that competitiveness perhaps, or what have you.
Yes.
Just even the pressure we put on ourselves, even if it's not against anyone.
Insane pressure.
I mean, it's like you cultivate your own pressure cooker, and you drop yourself in, and you put your own lid on, and you're like, here I go, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy. But like, where did that even come? Like, why did you even want to get yourself into a pathway that would procure really all of the bumps, the bruises, the cuts that you get? Because that's what happens when you're in a high pressure and high stakes environment.
Yeah. So my, that's a great question. And so my history, and I'll share two parts really here, and happy to share as much as you would like, but really my drive for business really stems from, and this will be a chapter that's in my second edition that I'm working on. So I'll share a little teaser lead into that, is my childhood was really interesting. I ended up being adopted by my stepfather. who at the time, when I was 6 or 7, he was also an abuser, a sexual abuser, a sexual predator. And I was, you know, threatened by my father that if I ever, or my stepfather, that if I ever told anyone that I would never see my mother again. I mean, and you believe that when you're, I believe that when I was 6, 7 years old. So fast forward, my parents divorce. And then my mother is struggling to try and make a living. And this was, you know, back in the 70s. So employment was different for women to try and make a living and support a child, even though she had child support and so forth. Well, she ended up meeting this gentleman. I wouldn't even say gentleman, this guy, right, that gave her an ultimatum and said, either the kid goes or I go. So she, on a whim, picked up the phone and called my stepfather, who was now in Southern California. I was in Illinois at the time, and said, do you want her? And he said, if I take her, I will do it legally. So lo and behold, they drafted all the documents, and my abuser became my true father. And I was put on a plane and sent to Southern California to begin my life as his daughter, who, and he had just been recently remarried in all of 2 weeks. And then suddenly I had a new stepmom. So a whole new life, major detour, right? So that put me on this path of quite a predicament to be in. And I was at that. I was at that point, I was 8. So the abuse started when I was 6. And then I was separated from it because my parents divorced. So, whew, right, I'm okay. And then suddenly I'm not okay, right? I'm on a plane and I'm back in the mix of it and absolutely terrified. So I remained silent, as unfortunately many abused people do, remain silent out of absolute horror and shame and fear. Just I was petrified. And he was also a very dominant personality. And the abuse had stopped when my, I do want to clarify that. When I had moved back out to California and my stepmother was living there under the same roof, and I was never alone with my father, and I did everything I could do to avoid, you know, being around him or at any stake. At 17, I ran away from home. Now, I was in living with my father. Sorry, this is a tough story to share. So I'm sorry if I'm kind of humming and hawing along.
That's okay.
So in living with him, once I ran away, well, I had a very affluent life. Let's just put it that way. He was very successful as a businessman. I wanted for nothing. I had a, you know, very, very spoiled young girl. And so when I ran away from home, I was given an ultimatum that if I left, that I would no longer be a part of the family. So I ended up deciding to continue to stay away. And he followed through with that and cut me off from the from my family, my stepsister, my stepmom, my grandmother. I mean, it was really horrific for me. And so that set me on this course of trying to, you know, if it's to be, it's up to me. I mean, that famous quote became my reality. And I was very hard-headed and persistent. And he had made a comment to me that I would never amount to anything. You know, that I was going to be white trash and never amount to anything. And so that was really something that ignited a tremendous fire in me to prove him wrong and to figure out how am I going to take care of myself and still help me, God, I will never even make a collect phone call if I'm going to, you know, figure out how to make my own path. So I would say most definitely that's what really ignited that drive for me, is just to figure out how do I take care of myself. And at 17, since I was quite spoiled, I didn't have any competence when it came to responsibility or self-care, right? So that was a tough learning curve. But I learned quickly and I started to self-develop. And I ended up, you know, I was on a path, academic path, where I was in the top 10% of my class. And I was on what they called the Daisy Chain, which is a very, you know, those are the top GPAs. And I'd been accepted to multiple universities. And I just had, you know, some would say I had like the dream, right? It was all laid out for me, but nobody knew the darkness.
Or that you were doing this entirely on your own.
On my own.
Right. I mean, you were so, really in survival mode.
And completely. I understand that.
Yeah. Fear, survival, running, you know, and just, and not knowing, that was my method of coping. You know, it wasn't like I had a therapist. It wasn't like I told anybody. So my method of coping for a young 17-year-old girl who was, literally, drenched with shame and fear was to run and to figure out just how do I make ends meet? How do I put food on the table, a roof over my head? So fast forward, I start putting it together. I was not able to complete school because I had to buy groceries. And so I was forced into working, and I ended up very ambitious. And so fast forward back to 25. I'm now in the Atlanta market. I'm working for a top real estate company that's based out of Chicago. And I end up earning an opportunity because of my numbers being incredible. And this was a very large company. I earned an opportunity to say, well, we're going to promote you, relocate you, and we're going to make you a manager, which happens to a lot of people where we get promoted to our level of incompetence. And, you know, the infamous Peter principle. And so that's exactly what happened to me. I ended up, 25, downtown Chicago, top floor apartment overlooking this beautiful skyline. I had arrived in all intents and purposes, but unfortunately my bags did not have leadership skills packed in them. So it wasn't long after that that I ended up having what I call the cataclysmic fall from grace, where I blew up a team because I didn't know how to communicate. And I was a bad boss, really bad boss. And I tried to mimic what I saw my father do with employees, which was very old school, very autocratic, top down. And so that was my idea of what I thought a leader was.
You didn't use threatening language. You used a threatening presence.
Yes, I didn't use threatening language. And I was a micromanager to the nth degree. And I withheld positive feedback or recognition or praise because I was, twofold. I was fearful because I was a young female in a progressive urban environment. And I had made up the story in my head that if I give praise, that they'll take their foot off the gas or they'll take advantage of me, right? And so, which I had it completely wired wrong. And so what ends up happening with teams is they, in my team in particular, conspired behind my back and they planned a walkout. And the worst thing about it is I never saw it coming. I had no, because on paper, we were killing it. We were getting it done. Our scorecard looked great. And that's the, isn't that the double-edged sword for leaders that are successful in spite of themselves? And that, that was my problem is.
Yeah. Well, it's especially true when we're only looking at that side of the equation. We have a mission, we have a goal. Don't care how it gets done. It just needs to get done. When really that's only 25%. The other 75 is like the experience that people get to have and the happiness or the level of success that they get to feel. And of course we know all those things now, but when you're young and you are so insecure about your own performance or your own ability to rein in and take charge and be respected. I mean, there's just a lot of ego that gets wrapped up in there, but I really feel like we can call it down to insecurity because.
Yes, for sure. For
young,
me.
Even if you were in your 30s, it's just a new leadership role without experience from a leader that you admire mm-hmm. and respect who really takes you through each of the lessons and each of the phases and steps. Like that would have been the only other way that you could have been given or felt equipped to manage and really essentially deal with people. You could deal with numbers and you could deal with sales because you had proven that, hence you got the job. But in terms of the people skills, it's always the stuff that comes after. And I will tell you, I had that a similar experience just in terms of like having like my own head up my own ass, and mm-hmm. so it's not a moment we want to look back and cheer, but there is a celebration in there somehow in order.
As long as you extract the lesson, right? That's where you get to celebrate is what did we do with that experience?
Yeah. Can I learn from this or where can I look at the absolute utter failure and how do I not have a repeat performance?
Yeah. And
interesting.
Yeah, I would love to, take credit for, and it was unfortunate because if you think about, you know, here I was essentially, well, a runaway, not essentially, I was a runaway who'd been banned from my family. So I lost all of that parental guidance, right?
That foundation.
And then, yeah, and then I was just really, you know, here I was insecure, competitive, and very ambitious. That's a lethal combination,
yes.
Right? When you don't have the competence and you don't have the training and development, sometimes it's a really dangerous mix. And yes. For me, it was very unproductive when it came to human capital. And the collateral damage was terrible. I mean, when we as leaders fail our people, the collateral damage goes beyond the office. It goes into their families, into communities, into the grocery store when they run errands on their way home, how they interact with the cashier or someone, road rage. We're hearing a lot about road rage this day and age. You know, we are responsible as leaders for cultivating those ripple effects that go beyond the office.
I think we're responsible as people.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly.
Responsible for putting out goodness, kindness, compassion, and love, or putting out the polar opposite, which has horrific reverberating effects on everyone. And you're right, it does. It becomes a part of a person's thought process in the car, how they make decisions, how they speak to people, and then how those people respond to that poor, you know, exchange that they had, and how that changes their day and their mood. And
yes.
How they go home and speak to people.
It's a massive ripple.
Or deal with the next customer, like whatever it is. It's the worst thing that can happen, which is why, well, we know better now, of course, but why each of us does have that responsibility as just humans.
Yes,
never
most
mind
definitely.
Leadership when it's even more at play.
You know, then you just pour gasoline on it and light a match because it accelerates it, right? Because your credibility is at stake. People look up to you. I mean, there's so much more at stake when we're in a leadership role, and particularly a title. I mean, anybody can be a leader regardless of title. But when your title is a leader, there's a tremendous responsibility that you have to human capital, all human capital.
Yeah, there's an expectation. So, and, you know, there are many people, young people that, regardless of where they come from and what foundation they may or may not have, like a sturdy one, they're still looking to you, to me, to whoever their leader might be, for the wherewithal, for the guidance. They're maybe early in their careers and they don't know how this goes. I mean, they think they might have an idea of how it should be, but they don't know how this goes. And you're training, you're essentially modeling what comes next, right?
Yes,
so
yes, you sure are.
It's an interesting dynamic, I think so.
That's why I go back to that. If it's to be, it's up to me. I mean, that is the mantra that fuels me even today, is that, you know, I get to be responsible for everything, you know, both personally and professionally. I think that's, to me, is very empowering to take that ownership. And I enjoy it, as opposed to, you know, it's much healthier than a victim mindset and blaming others. You know, I love to be responsible for the relationships I get to have and for the impact I get to make, both personally and professionally. So I find that is posted in my closet on my wall.
I think what's super cool is that first gig where your team conspired to have a walkout, to quit at one time. I know your story and I've read your book, and that is absolutely what happened. And I love the conversation that you then had to have with your boss immediately following, mm-hmm. which I can imagine. And it's funny because I'm reading it, and because I've had a similar experience, not necessarily my own, but I've been in similar uncomfortable places. I actually felt the lump in my throat. When
it's terrible.
And I know that was not an ideal situation for you to have to report that in. But mm-hmm. the coolest thing, I mean, to me, it's like the best, was this great leader you essentially had, because you didn't lose your job, and maybe you should have and could have. Mm-hmm. The should have, who cares? So the could have was absolutely on the table.
Yes.
More importantly, you were actually working for someone who took some responsibility for not ensuring that you had someone to model management and leadership style and support to you, and decided to teach you and to show you and to give you a chance to create and evolve as a leader, as a young leader, and to harness those skills and attributes. And like, that's the break that we're all really looking for in this life. We all just want to be given a second chance, even a third one. We all want to be given the chance and the opportunity to right our wrongs and to fix, because we can't always know from the onset that we're doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. And it does take falling on our face very often. And look, let's face it, you and I are the ones who are out there saying, you know, be fearless or take your fear with you. Or we are constantly reminding people that life isn't perfect and that you can't wait until you think you're ready, because you're never going to get there.
That's right.
So the fact that we understand mistakes are inevitable and they're actually critical to the whole process. Failure is critical to the process. There is no learning without failure. So that was your first massive lesson. It wasn't just that people walked out and you realized you might be doing it wrong. Your huge lesson was that someone said, I still have faith in you. I still believe in you. And I still want you to be the person that's running my organization. And I want to help ensure that you get to do that right. And let's face it, I have a very similar background to yours. I grew up in violence. I grew up, I'd say 17 on my own, same thing. I lived in survival for a long time, didn't finish my education, academic education in college till recently. So I hear you. I was always looking for someone to give me a chance and give me a shot, because I didn't have that foundation like you didn't have that foundation.
No. I think that's great.
To me, like, that's like, oh, when I hear that and I think of that start of your story, I'm like, that's like a big bouquet of flowers. That's like, oof, that's just tremendous.
It was a great gift. And, you know, and this was a time, you know, I'm a baby boomer. So this was in the early 1990s. So it was still, especially in an urban, this was in downtown Chicago. So heavy urban. And I was in a leadership position. And so it was very heavily, you know, male oriented in executive positions. And it was still quite autocratic and very top down. And that was acceptable. That was, but for me, you know, it's funny and I guess we do it to ourselves, but when women are, call it bossy, they're perceived as bitchy. Right. And so that was my style. It was just, I was definitely bossy, and I was very lucky and gifted with not only the feedback, because thank God that team walked out and said, you're this, that, and the other, and we're out of here because you suck as a boss. Because the worst, what's even worse is when they leave one at a time and then you don't notice that it's you, right? And so with my team, there was no mistaking. I was the common denominator. I was clearly the problem. And I was really fortunate that my leader, the person I reported to at the time, still saw my potential and thought, hey, you know, you're going to have to work on this leadership thing. I'm going to give you another shot, but you've got to get this thing right. And then I went into, again, it goes, I guess, back to that sales mode, to where, you know, if it's to be, it's up to me. And, you know, I'm going to get my hands on everything I can to conquer this and to figure this people thing out, because I need to give people a reason to get out of bed and come to play on my team in the morning. And I needed to build a whole new team. And so that became my quest, if you will, where I just, you know, started consuming and reading everything I could and there wasn't a whole heck of a lot back then.
I was just going to ask you, leadership. Like, where do you turn and who were your early advisors that you tapped into? Like, even if it were just like online or through books, but like, who were those early?
There wasn't even online then. I went to a bookstore, right? Physically went to a bookstore and I picked up Ken Blanchard's The 1 Minute Manager. And then I picked up Stephen Covey's 7 Habits. Those were the two books that I read first. And then I read this other book called, I think it was called Shut Your Mouth. And I really needed that book. And some would say I still need it. But I started reading there. And then really the biggest aha for me was when I had finally assembled the new team, right? Hired everybody. And it was rather complicated. If you recall in the book, the team that walked out were unionized. And so we're talking downtown Chicago, old school unions. It's like messing with the mob, right? It's not a good thing, right? And I certainly, you don't want to make enemies with the unions. You need them. They're your partners in success. And so I learned a lot. I was schooled very heavily at a young age. So I was 25, 26 when this happened. That was a great gift, even though it was a tough seeing the choke down. Yeah, really, really tough. But it really did have me evolve very quickly and understand the importance of building bridges and relationships, and then really assembling a team that enjoys not only one another, but also respects and likes working for you, because then that's going to lead to outcomes. So it changed. It really shifted my paradigm on away from being heavily results and performance oriented to being people oriented to get the performance and the results.
But the thing is, those moves, those gestures, that learning, it takes time. I imagine it was a slow process. So you had a little bit of like your old self, and then you had this new understanding. Like it's because I mean, look, we don't get where we are overnight, whether it's in a good or a bad habit forming position. And so changing and shifting out of things, first of all, you needed to educate yourself, and you needed to hopefully get yourself involved or around people who could model that behavior for you, because that's always helpful.
And that took time. It took time to find a mentor. It took time to find a mentor. I didn't have any at the time. And that's why lesson two is stop, drop, take a selfie, because that's where I had to start first, right? As I started working on myself. A lot of times, you know, today, you know, let's fast forward to today, and I'm a consultant and a coach, and work for all different types of industries in supporting leaders, teams, and executives. And inevitably, I'll get the email or the phone call that says, hey, I need you to come out and, you know, I have a people problem. I need you to fix my team. And I'm like, okay, great. Well, let's start with your mirror and really get into, because usually, or not usually, always in my opinion, the team is a reflection of leadership. So if the team is struggling, what is the leader doing or not doing that's not working for the team? You know, maybe they've hired some bad apples, but that's still on the leader. So it's really about introducing your mirror. And that's what lesson two was all about. That's where I started, is I really started on self-development and becoming self-aware. And then also that's where it leads into lesson three. Let's talk about trust, baby, being vulnerable and telling the new team what I did to the old team. That was a tough conversation, but an important one.
Big, big move for you to make, because so many people in that situation, regardless of age, but especially because you were younger at that point, still considered relatively younger, that's a really big, vulnerable move. And bravo to you for whatever you were doing to scramble, whatever, you know, insecurities you were feeling, because that had to have rattled you to your core, the fact that you were exposed now as not being perfect or not being successful or not just not being what you needed to be. I mean, that must have really just made you insane to fix. And so you were smart enough to know that you needed to be 100% transparent, tell the story, let them know that that is true in case they hear heard otherwise.
Right. I wanted them to hear it from me.
You're better to narrate the story than someone else. And and then start from ground zero, because what else do you have?
Yeah, no, I had to come clean. It's an important part of the journey. And I also needed them to know that I wasn't fixed, that I was just aware, right? And that I still had a lot of work to do, but we had to figure this thing out together, and gave them permission to give feedback. And that was actually one of the most powerful conversations I remember ever having. Tough, lots of ugly crying going on my part. And because a lot of shame is associated with that type of a failure. There's so much human collateral damage that happens when we fail our people. And for me, it was, you know, mortifying as a new manager. And also, you know, going back to my childhood story, right? I was like, I'll be damned if I'm going to fail now, because then my dad will be right. So I have to get this leadership thing right. So I had a lot of different things that were firing up my engines at the time. But I knew that humility was something that I needed to do. And what was interesting is I wasn't prompted. My company didn't put a gun to my head and say, hey, you need to tell your team. You know, it was just, I felt like I owed it to them. And I imagined that they would find out one way or another. But I really wanted them to know that, look, we've got to, you know, we're going to kind of bolt this thing together as a team, and I'm going to make mistakes, and I want you to call me out on the carpet, and really kind of shared the story of what my vision for the team I wanted to have would look like, and got their weigh-in. I mean, I didn't really understand what I was doing at the time, but But now that I'm have the beauty of hindsight, that was really the right and the best thing to do. And I think for any leader, when we make those mistakes, the sooner we can share those failures and lessons learned, it allows other people permission to share the same. And absolutely. And I have a philosophy that a belief, and I actually was going to write a book about it, but I'll share it here. That, you know, in agriculture, which I had the pleasure of supporting quite heavily over the past 9 years, I think it's been now. It's been, you know, the two percenters of those who feed the world. They use manure to fertilize and grow crops and feed families and feed our country and feed the world, right? And in life, I just kind of look at, you know, pardon the expression, shit happens, right? And so it's kind of the same thing as manure. What we do with it, you can either use as an excuse to flush away all your hopes and dreams and be a victim to the shit that happens to you, or you can treat it like manure and go, hey, this is great fertilizer. And so how am I going to, you know, fertilize this to propel me toward my dreams?
I love that.
So that's my cheesy story, but it's not cheesy.
It actually makes sense. You're like, no, because if you think about it, this is like so exciting to me. You're living in emotional sustainability. I just made that up because that's exactly
I love
what it speaks to me. It says that we even emotionally, we should be able to turn things over and not leave anything to be thrown out, because all parts matter, and we can actually just keep recycling them to make them work and make them fit the way we do anything else that's physical and tangible. We can be doing all of those things with the way in which we think and behave, and therefore it's a no waste dynamic. And I love that. I mean, it speaks volumes to me. And it really speaks to your third point of let's talk about trust, baby, because what you were already sort of seeding by you being vulnerable, by you sharing who you are and the mistakes you've made, and obviously looking and opening it up to feedback, obviously for your own self and behavior, but also opening it up so that the team could share whatever was on their mind. If they had made mistakes, you know, they could then be vulnerable and they could share.
Yes.
So like you're creating this cohesive bond suddenly. And it's like, we're in this together. And you were turning the me to we on right then and there. Mm-hmm. You knew that that was going to be more a recipe for success than what you had already experienced to that point in time.
And it just felt, and it just felt right, you know, and it's, you know, and it's an interesting thing, because when I look back at my life, including the most, the darkest periods, you know, when I was 6 and 7 and being abused and absolutely petrified, and then running away and not finishing college, being an amazing student, and then, you know, taking a complete detour in life, down a different path that also tacked on a lot of professional shame for me. I look at all the choices I've made today and where, based on where I sit today. And I look back and say, I wouldn't change any of it, even the abuse, because I am who I am. I'm a product of all of those experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so I like who I am today. And I think that the ability that I have to connect with my clients, my friends, family, just people, the empathy that I have and how much I can, you know, appreciate, you know, people's journey, all of that is a gift and an outcome that I've been able to enjoy based on that, you know, the shit, if you will, and also the success.
You used it all. I mean, we don't need to be abused in order to be smart, savvy, and understand these key points to life. But at least you can say that the circumstances you found yourself in, you were able to continue to use all parts to continue to contribute to who you are and be a better person for it, and turn it into something and not just have it be only what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so, and that's what I invite people to do, is I really, you know, okay, so shit happens. So, all right, convert that to fertilizer. Let's reframe it to fertilizer. And okay, so what are you going to, so what now, what are we going to do with it?
I love that. So over time, obviously, you know, there were a few more opportunities that you latched onto that seemed like great opportunities, but you did find yourself in situations where you ended up working for crazy people who are narcissists or passive, who are this or that. I mean, look, I hear that. I mean, I think in sales, sadly, we end up with leaders, or I should just say executives.
Yeah. Titled people.
They're just
titled not
people,
leaders.
Right?
Yeah.
Who really lead with such poor behavior and such negative almost like it's really abusive.
It's bullying. It's bullying.
It's complete bullying. I mean, I've been bullied by men and women in the business, and it's like so unnecessary. It obviously lowers productivity. No one feels comfortable. Everyone's walking on eggshells, and you cannot get anything done in those circumstances. You can't. But yet it continues. You work for a few more people who have some of those characteristics. It is shaping you. You are doing the right thing, at least protecting your team. I've worked for great, great leaders who did that too. They were the buffer between the top executive staff and us. And I thank them to this day. I feel so grateful because I learned so much from them. And that was a big lesson that I learned too, is that they protected us at every step. And they were willing to take the beatings and the abuse and the verbal, you know, rants because they opted in there. It never lasts because no one can stay in roles.
It's like not, before, no. Right.
Thankfully, because it's almost a tug of war. It's like, well, are they going to be like dismissed? Could they possibly leave? Are we all going to get to keep this? Or at some point you're like, forget it. You win.
I'm out.
You know, go ahead. Do what you got to do.
And there's that great potential. You know, I don't regret those experiences. They've made me more effective as a coach and as an entrepreneur and as a business leader, because it enabled me to figure out, you know, when I worked for the narcissistic boss, and I did that for about 3 years, it was tremendously educational for me. And I went in eyes wide open. I didn't go in with blinders on. I was told, I knew his reputation and he was an owner, so there was no chance he was going to be leaving. So, and I went in with, I had respected the person who recruited me for the position, who was very transparent about the circumstances and call it the state of the union, if you will, that I was really going into the firing lines, in the front lines, and it was going to, you know, the heat was going to be on. And so it really helped me find my, I don't want to say mothering instincts, but definitely I looked out for my team. And then I also learned how to communicate with someone in that position and learned how to be solution oriented, learned how to cut to the chase, learned how to communicate platinum style, as I reference in the book, which is we serve it up the way they like to have it versus the, you know, golden rule, which is the way we like to be communicated with. And so it really made me and empowered me to be an owner with, to operate as a business owner within a corporate structure that was volatile. So I created my own musketeer team of the all for one, one for all. We had the most amazing team within this very, very toxic and explosive culture. And so my reason for choosing to share that in the book had a lot of different layers to it. But the main message is that, you know, sometimes our circumstances offer us an opportunity that may seem like, oh, there's no way I can be successful. I can't create a culture in this environment. And you can. And if you don't have an option to opt out, which I would encourage you, you know, exit stage left and find a new ship if you can. But in this case, I made the decision to go into the front lines. And so I had a responsibility not only to the person I committed to, who was very transparent with me, I had a responsibility to the team. And I had given myself a 3-year commitment. And I stayed there for the 3 years, and life changed for us. And the way he interacted with me changed as well. And I shared a little bit of that story in the book. But I think bully bosses, narcissistic bosses, they teach us, just like those amazing, you know, people leaders who inspire us to go, gosh, I want to be like her when I grow up, or him when I grow up. You know, as a leader, we can extract lessons out of both of those experiences. And my hope is, you know, you just belly up to the bar and drink in as much as you can and figure out how you can translate that in a way that makes you a badass leader.
Yeah, no. And I think it's critical, as you've pointed out, to be able to have the experience on both sides so that you really do understand this exists. It goes on. This is what it looks like. This is what it, more importantly, this is what it feels like.
Yeah.
God, the vibe and the energy in a toxic, you know, workspace. Oh, I often think that is so much more damaging than the words that are uttered or the explosive, you know, tirades that someone might have. But that feeling of being uncomfortable in a really bad way, a negative way. Oh, there's just nothing like it. It's terrible. It's like you're swimming in a toxic pool. No one wants to be there. No one. And even for those who are so-called blocking it out, their productivity is no way at optimal levels.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. It's not healthy. It's not healthy mentally, emotionally, physically. And it certainly doesn't translate great margin performance, right? And it's asinine for owners and leaders to behave in that manner. And what's interesting is when you have people in positions of power with a lot of money, and that this was the case, what power they have to be abusive and to not be held accountable. It's shameful. And I really struggled with, you know, that again, the book is my journey and the lessons that I learned and the things that there are a lot of things I would have done differently. If I could have, knowing what I know today, would I have taken that position today if it was offered to me? Not for any amount of money in the world.
Right.
But at the time, I didn't take it for the money because it really wasn't a big financial bump for me. It was the challenge. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to say, you know, could I be the one that actually could create and build a team within this structure? And could I be successful? It was a challenge that I was ready for and really welcomed. And also out of tremendous respect for this woman that was a leader in the organization that I, you know, she's one of those leaders that I was like, oh gosh, when I grow up, I want to be like her. And I thought I did it for her. And I also did it because I thought I wanted to know, did I have what it takes? And could I do this and face this challenge? Could I suck it up, buttercup, and get in there and be in the struggle and be successful in spite of how shitty the circumstances were? And
that's
I was
going to ask you, do you think at that stage, like I get it, the whole challenge of, you know, feeling determined to create something that didn't exist there and that you knew would be, you know, a lot to step into. But were you still trying to prove something to yourself? And do you think you were still trying to prove something to the inner part of you that your father kind of pissed off?
Oh, like you bet.
Like, was it just
no doubt
following you? And also
combined
with the fact that the first gig blew up so brutally and so quickly.
Yes.
I mean, I imagine those two massive blows, like the one that's deeply seated, of course, comes from the parental aspect of this, but then going out on your own and kind of falling a little on your face.
Oh, you bet. Falling big time.
Yeah. And so between both of those scenarios, you were fueled to also prove all of that historical stuff wrong.
Yes.
You were on a mission.
I was hell-bent.
Yeah, hell-bent.
Hell-bent. And it was a great experience. And I embrace it fully, but I wouldn't have a do-over. Like I wouldn't, if somebody could offer me millions of dollars to go do that again. And it wouldn't, it doesn't, it, that to me, emotional currency is more enriching for me. I'm not in it for the material aspect. I'm really in it for, I want something that makes me feel good and that aligns with my values, and that does no longer align with my values at that point in time, because I was still trying to arrive, be successful on this particular asset that I was going to be over. You know, I was going to be overseeing. Oh my gosh. I want to estimate it at about $500 million, if not more. It was huge.
Yeah.
And to be in my 20s and overseeing that type of an asset in, you know, the skyline of Chicago, most prestigious real estate market, most prestigious real estate address at the time, you know, there was a lot of ego that was tied to that. And it was kind of that, to dad, you know, that, hey, look at me now, right?
Exactly.
So there was that aspect that definitely was an underlayment in that decision. But I didn't fail the team. I really went in and committed. And that really solidified me as a leader of people.
Right.
And so in as much as that environment,
demons over here,
it was kind of like it made the diamond
fence anymore.
Yes.
But I still have to work this out, because this over here is, I'm not done with this yet.
Yeah. But it's interesting, because if you think about how diamonds are made, you know, that's exactly what that pressure and that whole narcissistic environment and trying to be successful in spite of my circumstances and trying to prove my dad, that was the catalyst that really shaped me as a leader. You know, I wouldn't I wouldn't erase it from my past, but I wouldn't invite it again. Right. It was tough.
Well, it done. You don't have to repeat the lessons we learn when the heat is on and we get burned. We're like, okay, lesson learned. Let's move on. So yeah, we never have to do that again. But
it was nice because my exit from that was beautiful. And I got fantastic feedback from all different levels. It was a team that I still am connected with, a couple of those team members today. And it's been, fast forward, this was in, 2000 or 2001 that I left. And fantastic experience. I mean, left on the best of terms, open door policy, it was just fantastic. So that was nice to be able to choose to step out when I was at the top of my game, And so that was very gratifying for me.
I bet. So let me ask you, because you obviously are an executive coach, you work with different CEOs, organizations, industries, people. What's the problem now? It's 2021. Why is it taking so long for CEOs, executives to understand the lesson about taking care of your people? Where are we in terms of that? And why is it still such a perpetual issue that needs to be constantly addressed? Like, why is bullying still happening in the workplace?
I know, right?
Because all of these leaders go to different leadership, environments and retreats, and they read things and they mingle and rub elbows with all sorts of people. And you and I both know there are a tremendous amount of people out there that are super successful now, from the Tony Robbins to the Simon Sinek's of the world.
Yes.
And we could keep talking about them. And, you talk about many of them in your book. And I love that, because I love latching onto the ones I hadn't read yet, but I have read many. What's the holdup here? I just feel like I have an expectation of CEOs and executive leaders that by now, if you're in that role, shame on you if you haven't looked at the really successful companies and leaders out there who treat people kindly. And you haven't learned something from them, that you still are doing things the way that you're doing them. I'm sorry. I have a problem with that.
I agree. So. Oh my gosh. I completely agree and echo everything you've said. And I also think that we're at the tipping point, maybe not in 2021, but I think that there's so much energy and so much conversation. There are so many demands that are being, now voiced. There's a voice. And so I think the tolerance is becoming less and less. And it's not okay. You just think about, it started in the television industry where they were calling out, the directors that were abusive. I mean, it's just been slowly building to this, what I call this big climatic event or tipping point, where I really feel that in order to be an executive, if you don't prioritize people of performance, you shouldn't be in position. And I don't think we're there yet. I think there's still a lot of power and ego and top down, and everybody's kissing ass. That's why, lesson 9 is don't be a kiss ass, And I think, again, badass leadership is unconventional. Some people are afraid of it. It's not for everyone, because they look at the brand and they go, oh my gosh, that seems risky. Well, I think it's riskier not to look at the 12 leadership lessons, and you should be embracing this sooner rather than later, and dig in and look in the mirror. But unfortunately, there are still the powers that be that are out there that are what I call, it's lip service. Like they talk about culture and they put it in their mission statements and in their vision statements, and they do it on their onboarding, but they don't walk the talk. The culture doesn't exist. It's just a saying that they want the public to see, that it's more for their customers. But they're not executing. And I think that there's going to be a lot of whistles blown, and people that are going to say, call them on the carpet. And I'll tell you what, this younger generation is going to be the generation that calls them out.
They're not having it. I'm telling you right now, they're not having it. And I love that. I actually am too.
I think so it's awesome.
I have been a person who has at different times in her career called people out. Not always graceful in the beginning. I had to learn to become more graceful in that process, because there's really nothing graceful about being a whistleblower or going in and saying, guess what? Not taking this. Like, this is unacceptable. But it's really important to do. And it was sad, because I was in my own position. It was obvious what was happening. I could not get anyone to side with me. People who witnessed
fear,
bullying all the time. Like they were like, oh yeah, you did, but you know, you can't use my name. Like I can't speak on your behalf. And so that was a really sad truth that I had to bear it all on my own. You know, I did several times, but it sucked. Let's face it.
It really
the
does.
Day, it sucked to be the lone one out there, you know, and you had to cut your own fishing line at that point and just cut yourself free because you couldn't take it. And it wasn't fair. And quite honestly, I actually like myself. I really love myself. And I cared about my own health and well-being. So leaving was my option. It was the best one, but I didn't do it without speaking up first. And I like this younger generation because they're not going to wait to get themselves into that pickle. Chances are most often it's going to be where they just don't accept those terms and conditions.
Or they out you, which I think is great. Yeah. Because I think that, you know, we for shame, right? Shame on these organizations for, you know, touting one thing and then doing another. I think it's about time that we, you know, we walk the talk. I mean, in simple terms, I think it's really important that we put our sayings and our vision statements, and we put them into practice, and that our entire executive team is accountable to that, as well as any other leader, any other person that's within the organization. And at the end of the day, the organizations that choose to do that, you want to talk about multipliers to outcomes and margin performance. It's insane. I mean, I just think and I go, oh my God, why, if they're successful in spite of themselves, imagine what would be possible when they get it wired right.
And everyone's on board and everybody wants to win and no one needs to be sacrificed in order for the achievements to occur. I love that. And I have to say, I probably would have stayed in certain environments longer if that were the case. Even if, the product wasn't the best, we might not have been at the top position, but we were really good and we were good enough to continue accelerating. I would say that, it's so much more fun when you feel safe, as Simon says. You feel safe, feel trusted, and you feel cared for.
And you know what? And if the product isn't the best, when you create that extra mile behavior and that culture, they're going to own that product. They're going to find out what the problem is and they're going to make it better.
Well, that's it,
you know?
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's
possible then to elevate even further.
Yeah, everything becomes possible. And so the prioritization is just so, to me, it's just so, it's so mind-blowing that everybody isn't doing this. Because
that's why I'm like sitting here saying, what the heck is the problem? Because it's like, wait a second, it's 2021. Like we've been through so much. I know during our adult lifetime, we've been through so much in the world, in the country, in business, you know, seeing so much advancement and change and really for the better. And it's a lot of stuff is positive. Even though I know we have negative hovering, I feel like there's a lot of positive that just continues to accelerate and move forward. And that's why I'm like, but wait a minute, what the heck? Like, why do we still have that going on? And what is the whole point of it? It doesn't make any sense to me. Because if you really care about the bottom line and being in a number one position, it's like, dude, ladies
and gentlemen, get your priorities straight.
Exactly. It's like, at what point did anyone take away that whipping was going to win over like kindness and compassion? I feel like we've already been able to see the results of both of those activities. And it's just so obvious which one gets you further.
Yeah. So. and it's so, you know, I've lived for too long in what I call Stepford organizations, where they're cookie cutter and there's artificial harmony and everybody's kissing ass and people are back channel talking about what they really think. But no one's going to run it up the chain because the channel can't handle it. They can't handle the feedback. They're not asking for it. They're not open to it. And then there's retaliation. If you do, even if you do, you know, try and package it a certain way, you know, if it at all seems like a perceived threat to, you know, so it's very unhealthy. And to me, one of the things that I was very fortunate in my, just before I left and decided to step away from corporate America and start my own leadership development company, I had this team of right around, between my internal and external team members, I had right around 165 people or so on the team. And we were musketeers. I mean, it was the most insane and fun and productive. I was like, I had 165 entrepreneurs all working with me and rowing in the same direction and having a blast. And we had tremendous goals that were in many cases very unrealistic, but we achieved them. And not only did we at minimum made the goals and in most cases beat them by a long shot. And that's what becomes possible when we foster foster and when we grow our people and we develop and we give real type coaching and we're a groupie for them and that we're transparent and sugar free, and then they can rise to their greatest potential. And that's what, to me, that's what being a badass leader is, you know, I think John Maxwell is the one who said, you know, I think it's along the lines of leaders create other leaders. And I mean, that's what the responsibility that I take with my team is I need to invest in their development, help them rise to their potential.
You've done that. And I think it's just brilliant that you've done that and so successfully, and you continue to spread that message and those skills to the clients that you deal with today. And I absolutely admire the work that you have done, that you continue to do. I mean, you're my kind of people in terms of, you know, you had some hard moments, meaning you tripped on yourself, but you're so willing to get up and learn from it and not continue the pattern of negative behavior. You were like, no, I can get this straight, I can get this right, and I can create something here. And again, early on, you were able to start creating a new foundation for yourself, and you've done that. And I love everything that you talk about. I love everything that you stand for. And yeah, I think we need more of it. And so the fact that you're sending leaders out there to be good leaders to the next succession of them is like brilliant. That's the whole point. Right.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, I thought it was a lot of fun, and I'm really excited to be able to share the unconventionality of the brand with your audience, because it is designed with great intention to not be like every other book or brand that's out there. I really wanted it to have a completely different and very approachable feel, and I wanted it to stand out and to not look cookie cutter. And because I think as leaders, that's what we have to do. We need to shake it up and turn it on its head, and we need to reprioritize, and we need to approach this leadership thing very differently.
That's right. And break those old molds. We really need to do that. So thank you.
For being here my pleasure.
Talking about your work and just how you see it. And so I appreciate it.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. And as always, this will not be our last gig. I know we're going to be enjoying some more conversations on Clubhouse, and I look forward to that and staying connected.
Absolutely. And I'll make sure that all of your information gets put into our show notes. But just once again, it's From Bad to Badass Leader, Live to Lead. And it's by Michelle Reinez. And I am going to post it, and I'm going to give away a book on this one. So everyone, prepare yourself. This is going to be a big deal. So thank you again for tuning in. And thank you for being here, Michelle.
My pleasure. And I wanted to just offer a free gift to your listeners. Awesome. So if they go to badassleader.com/podcast-gift, they can download lesson one for free. And then there are all types of screensavers and other free goodies on there for them. As long as they subscribe, they'll get the download in an email right away. But that should be fun and give them a little bit of an appetizer, which hopefully will leave them wanting more.
Absolutely. We will make sure everyone gets that too. Perfect. Thank you.
Sounds great. My pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Dreams and Detours. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe, and share it with your friends. You can find me at dreamsdetours.com and at dreamsdetours on Instagram. Thanks for listening.